Each year, it is my privilege to produce for you more than 200 Cato Daily podcasts featuring Cato scholars, outside experts, journalists, lawmakers, and others with interesting things to say. And at Cato, we accept no government money. We are entirely funded by private citizens and organizations. That means both Cato and the Cato Daily podcast are completely dependent on your support. To keep the Cato Daily podcast strong and growing, we've launched a new podcast sponsor program for this holiday season. Any and all donations to support the podcast are most appreciated, but at the $1,000 level of support, you'll become a Cato patron sponsor, which means you'll receive all the benefits of patron sponsorship. Additionally, unless you object, I'll personally thank you on the podcast. Cato is a 501c3 charitable organization, which means that your gift is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. To learn more, visit cato.org/podcast sponsor. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor. And as always, thank you for listening. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, December 27th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. It's a matter of dispute exactly when the bitter ideological and often partisan fights over judicial nominations started, but according to Cato's Ilya Shapiro, they're not going anywhere, and they may get more contentious. We spoke last week. Was there ever a golden age of judicial confirmation?
Well, it depends what you mean by that. We didn't even have hearings for judicial nominees until John F. Kennedy, really. Before, you occasionally had hearings when, for example, Louis Brandeis was nominated as the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. That was a big deal, as well as certain scandals that were going around during that time. So they had a hearing, but he didn't even testify. The first time that a nominee testified at his own hearing was sometime later, and that was for the Supreme Court. For lower court judges, they just kind of sailed through and were marked up like some other piece of legislation, and really there was no controversy. And that's in part because they were seen more as prizes to give cronies or leaders of the bar in the respective states, and senators controlled the process, and there was really nothing to it. It's only when the ideological wars or the jurisprudential wars heated up after the Warren Court in the 60s and 70s, and the response from conservatives with the origins of modern originalism, if you will, in the 80s with Ed Meese. And then Reagan's attorney general, and then you get into the smearing of Robert Bork when he was nominated to the Supreme Court, the Clarence Thomas hearings, the so-called high-tech lynching, the partisan fallout from Bush v. Gore, the ratcheting up of tensions with Harry Reid using for the first time a partisan filibuster against George W. Bush's nominees. 10 years later, he got rid of the filibuster for nominees, so the Democrats could get more people on the courts under Obama. And then, of course, the blockade of Merrick Garland's nomination last year, followed by getting rid of the filibuster to be able to confirm Neil Gorsuch. So it's just a ratcheting up of tensions with no end in sight.
All right. So, if a key moment here was going to a simple majority for confirmation of judges, what do you suspect that sort of? It's not the original sin here, but it is something. It is sort of a critical moment in ratcheting up this fight. Is there nothing but ideology for confirming judges now?
It looks like there's nothing but ideology or partisanship, which aren't always the same, but often are, to everything in our political life. I don't think judicial confirmations are any different in that respect to battles over repealing Obamacare or passing Obamacare for that matter, or tax reform or anything else. We've gotten to a moment in time where the parties are ideologically sorted, at least in Congress, setting aside what populism of the Trump or other variety might be doing going forward. But you have the Liberal Party and you have the Conservative Party, and there's no overlap. And They are more polarized due to lots of things, gerrymandering being one of them. On top of that, you map these different approaches to jurisprudence, so whether it be originalism versus living constitution or textualism versus purposivism in evaluating statutes. And it's a zero-sum game. There's no incentive for party opposite the president making the nomination to compromise in any way. And so you just have these majoritarian steamrolls, with the exception of certain parliamentary obstacles. Now, the filibuster was one. That's gone now. The next thing is the blue slip, which used to be very arcane, but you hear about it a lot. That's the prerogative of home state senators to delay or stall a nominee from going forward. Well, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has laid down the law and said that blue slips will not allow undue delay. If there's no good reason, you've looked at the nominee and they're the only thing you just don't like that person, then vote against them. The blue slip will not be honored in that case. And so the only possible escalation beyond that is if and when the Senate will be controlled by a different party from the White House, whether it's after next year's election or some other time in the future, will that Senate simply, the opposition party having the majority, not confirm any judges or virtually any? There's no point beyond that, I don't think, to go. And that's where we're headed, and there's really no way to stop it other than some sort of magical unwinding of the federal government or coming to a consensus or better consensus about the proper role of the judge. And I'm sorry to be the harbinger of depressing news, but I don't see a way out.
All that sounds very bad, but if you have judgeships overwhelmingly taken by people of one ideological stripe or another, the fact that the battle would be joined for different interpretations of the Constitution when it comes time to render decisions at these lower court levels, that doesn't seem bad to me. The fact that the fights would be bitter is, I guess, an acceptable casualty in a way. Do you have that view?
I do. And in fact, on the eve of the presidential election, when it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to win, I wrote a piece saying that Republican senators should vote against all of Clinton's nominees, not because as a matter of hashtag resistance, as we have it now against Trump, that everything he does is illegitimate or that everything Clinton would do would be illegitimate, but simply that the judges would be bad ideologically, jurisprudentially, in terms of constitutional and statutory interpretation. I don't begrudge senators deciding that a particular person would be not good for the health of the republic in terms of interpreting its laws. Probably more justified the higher you go. District judges don't necessarily determine those highfalutin jurisprudential things, or at least they're reviewed on appeal, of course. We've come to a point where, indeed, that battle is so cataclysmic that it is worth having, and it's worth not confirming too many people who are, from whatever your view is, would do damage to constitutional interpretation. That's not it's not necessarily a good thing for the country to have its leaders so polarized and having these bitter battles. But on the other hand, it's not good for the country to have bad judges, however you determine that. The one thing that I do hope comes out of this continuing war is perhaps some voter education. Disappointingly, that hasn't happened too much with how the Democrats have been opposing Trump's nominees. For example, when Don Willett had his confirmation hearing, now Fifth Circuit Judge Don Willett, the focus was on some tweets that he had making jokes about bacon and certain other things rather than, say, attacking him because of his jurisprudence being too in favor of economic liberty or something like that. I would hope at least that senators would use that opportunity, even if they're going to vote no, to explain why they're doing that rather than engaging in demagogy. But, I don't have, given what we've seen, I don't have too high hopes for that.
Is one benefit of all this that judges may be more fundamentally honest about their views? I know a lot of judges in pursuit of higher, of more important judgeships might shy away from making clear their interpretations of their true interpretations of certain elements of the Constitution.
Well, it used to be that when the White House and the Justice Department lawyers who are in charge of selection and vetting, when they were looking for nominees, they did indeed want no paper trails, a complete blank slate. But then after being burned too many times, either by people moving left while in office or simply not being as conservative or what have you, or originalist as they would have wanted, now it's a fine line. You have to have some sort of paper trail to signal that you would be reliable or favorable, however the ideological lean of those making the selections are, but not so much that you then have a problematic confirmation, although, as you implied, without the filibuster, there's a lot more leeway. Now, it doesn't mean that confirmation hearings themselves will get more interesting, because the advice is still to talk a lot and say very little. The nominees are trained to kind of talk around questions and things like that. But the types of nominees that we'll be getting, that we have been getting, are certainly more have more of that paper trail, seem more reliably of the direction that they're supposed to be from the perspective of the Trump administration officials, for example, than even under George W. Bush, let alone in earlier ages. So there will be some more honesty of that sort, but you really have to dig beyond the headlines and the public confirmation hearings to really find out about it.
So what is the fix? It seems to me that this kind of thing shouldn't be it seems not particularly sustainable, and one concern might be whether or not you have enough judges to actually rule on cases.
Yeah. This hasn't really gone down to the district court's nominees yet. A couple of Trump nominees have been withdrawn, but that's because of opposition from Republicans themselves. Concerns about lack of forthrightness in terms of various affiliations and speeches and things like that. So in terms of processing cases, hopefully the district courts won't be too affected, although, again, everything eventually ratchets up. There is no easy solution. For the Supreme Court, you could say, well, if we expand the court, then maybe each seat will be the battle for it will be less vicious. I don't know. But for the judiciary as a whole, really the only thing that will reverse or stop the process that we've seen, and it won't happen overnight, is, as I said, reducing the skies of government and having a more uniform appreciation for original public meaning of constitutional provisions and textualist approach to statutory interpretation. It took us decades to get to where we are now, and that's not going to be unwrapped overnight. As I said, judicial nominations are just one part of the larger struggles that we've seen over public policy in this country.
Ilya Shapiro is editor of the Cato Institute's annual Supreme Court Review. And now a special thank you to some particularly generous financial supporters of the Cato Daily Podcast, Ryan and Amy Ramagosa. Thank you for your generous support of the Cato Podcast and for being patron-level sponsors. Without supporters like you, we couldn't do our work at all, seriously. And if you would like to become a Cato Podcast sponsor like my dear friends and trusted allies, Ryan and Amy, visit cato.org/podcast sponsor.